Let's play Trump or Sanders today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Quick, which New Hampshire primary winner does this describe? Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders?
He is his own chief strategist, and he seems to be so far largely his own foreign policy advisor as well.
Find out the answer just ahead. Also, China cracks down on anyone who writes negative stories about officials, including gossip.
Some of this stuff is more like what you'd find in the National Enquirer, but it apparently is enough to infuriate the Communist Party.
Plus, British laws are still printed on parchment made from animal skins.
And it lasts for thousands and thousands of years.
But that's about to change. Say goodbye to vellum. These stories and more ahead on The World. Thanks for being with us today. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, both big winners in the New Hampshire primary, both with angry, raw rhetoric that their supporters love, and both with a dream to take the helm of the world's most powerful country. Oh, and there's one more thing Trump and Sanders have in common, the kind of thing you'd expect a show like The World to pick up on. Neither man seems to know a lot about global politics or have a well-defined foreign policy. We asked Susan Glasser, the editor of Politico, to help sketch out the two men's worldviews. She started with Donald Trump.
He's very much of a muscular America firster in his rhetoric. How that would really translate to his policies is not entirely clear. He makes a few rhetorical nods to having a strong military and that sort of a thing, but in reality, he seems to project a much more realist, pragmatic worldview when it comes to entanglements. Unlike Marco Rubio, for example, he's not interested in engaging the United States in military adventures abroad. His campaign is premised very much around the notion that he's going to focus on the American economy and building jobs here.
Trump seems to think the U.S. is overcommitted globally and that we're sort of being laughed at around the world. And so he seems sort of angry at our not only enemies, but allies, too. You know, we have these bases overseas and Germany's not paying for them in South Korea. Would you expect a Trump White House to pull back or exert more influence abroad?
Donald Trump has aggressively gone out of his way to alienate and say uncommonly negative things about America's closest partners in the world. And I think he is the quintessential unilateralist, but he seems to be a unilateralist who would be quite cautionary about actually using that military might. He's an ideologue. He's not pretending, I think, to offer people a coherent worldview as much as he is tapping into a latent frustration and anxiety that has really hung over the United States ever since the 2008 financial crisis.
Contrast Trump's worldview with Bernie Sanders.
Sanders, if you watch that debate the other day, he made an incredible face when even asked about the subject of foreign policy. He is very relentless about staying on message around the widening income gap in this country and around the world. He doesn't want to talk about anything else. He doesn't want to talk about globalization even. He doesn't want to talk about international economics. He wants to talk about our domestic politics. And, you know, really, he's quite ignorant. I was amazed. We had a reporter here at Politico look into the question of, well, who is Bernie Sanders' advisors even on foreign policy? The list that his campaign gave us included several people who denied ever speaking with his campaign, one person who's a Republican who said he gave one briefing and did so to many other candidates and certainly wouldn't consider himself an advisor. And he listed Ben Rhodes, the president's chief foreign policy speechwriter and deputy national security advisor, who is absolutely not by any means a Bernie Sanders advisor. Sanders does not even have a foreign policy team. He's not built that into the core of what his campaign has been about so far.
But clearly he's going to pull one together. That's what a lot of people are talking about now. Now that he's out there and he's seen as this viable candidate, that he's going to be asked about foreign policy issues. Is there anything that he's said so far or any indications of what his worldview is?
I think that he's going to face more and more questions about this, and perhaps he will assemble an actual team of advisors around him on this subject. But I don't think it's going to alter his core message. He's very skeptical, of course, of military engagement in the world. But as with his domestic policies, the proposals that he's gravitated towards over the years are things like eliminating or radically reducing the nuclear weapons arsenal, dramatically cutting back on U.S. defense spending, proposals that are unlikely to fly with this or any other Congress.
Do we know yet who's advising Donald Trump on his foreign policy platform?
It is a similarly murky thing. Donald Trump has defied conventions in this and all other things with his campaign this year. And the bottom line is that he is his own chief strategist. He's his own media advisor. And he seems to be so far largely his own foreign policy advisor as well.
Susan Glasser is the editor of Politico. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
Let's focus in for a minute on something Bernie Sanders said a few months back during a debate with Hillary Clinton.
And I think we should look to countries like Denmark, like Sweden and Norway, and learn from what they have accomplished for their working people.
Clinton responded, "I love Denmark." But then she went on to largely dismiss the idea that the U.S. is like Scandinavia. "We shouldn't turn our backs," Clinton said, "on American-style capitalism." So could a Scandinavian-style welfare state work here? The World's Jason Margolis went to Sweden to explore that question.
Let's begin with the basics. What exactly does a social democracy look like in Sweden? I started with a local bartender in Stockholm.
Chris Thompson, Winchester, Virginia, 32, Taurus.
Thompson has been in Stockholm for 8 years. He met a Swedish girl back in Virginia, and the rest is history. I asked him to explain Sweden's welfare state through an American lens.
I've been able to study Swedish for free. I've been to the hospital once due to a small choking incident. That cost me $20. Now, if I needed heart surgery or if I needed a piece of meat unlodged from my throat, it costs about the same.
Okay, free healthcare, free schools, free universities. What else?
The child issue is a big thing. We've been kicking around the idea of maybe going back for about a year before we have kids, come back to Sweden to have our children. I mean, 18-month paid leave is pretty hard to pass up.
You got 18
months? 18 months. Paid.
It actually works out closer to 16 months, but still. Thompson has to pay super high taxes for all of this, right? I asked how his paychecks in Stockholm and Virginia compare.
Taxes-wise, I haven't really felt much of a difference.
That's because the tax rates for middle-income earners in the two countries are pretty similar, around 25%. When salaries start to go up in Sweden, though...
Here you have the marginal tax rate, you see.
That's,
you
know, economist Harry Flam looking up tax rates on his computer. He's at Stockholm University. I asked him what he pays.
For a professor, 60%.
So you're paying 60% on the last dollar you earn?
Yes.
Are you okay with that?
Okay, yeah, it's okay.
Show me anybody in the United States that would be okay paying 60% in taxes. The highest marginal rate in the U.S. is currently just below 40%. As an economist, Flam thinks the upper tax rates in Sweden are too high. But he and many others I met in Sweden shrug it off when I ask if they're paying too much in taxes. Hey, they used to pay a lot more back in the 70s.
In some cases, you would have to pay more than 100% in tax on the margin.
That ended after the author of Pippi Longstocking wrote a satirical account about an overtaxed author.
She wrote a small children's story called Pomperipossa.
That sparked a national debate that led to a national tax reform. Today, chief economist of the Stockholm Chamber of Commerce, Andreas Hatzigiorgio, says most Swedes don't get upset about their high taxes because they trust the government. Here's the craziest thing I've heard in years.
The most popular public agency in Sweden today is the tax authority. And you can actually do your taxes just by answering a text message from the tax authority. If they trust the tax agency, they will just respond with a yes. So no hassle with accountants or anything like that.
How long does it take you to do your taxes?
Well, if you don't have any complicated things that you want to do, it takes you 5 seconds.
And you personally, though, how long does it take you?
I do my taxes in less than 10 minutes.
And Swedes trust the government with their money, too. Things work here. The trains run on time. A downside to all this efficiency, the upper middle class in Sweden is poorer than in the United States. Sweden does have its fabulously wealthy people, too, but doctors, lawyers, and engineers live a little bit more humbly. So would this trade-off work in the U.S.? I asked economists Andreas Hatzigiorgio and Harry Flam if Bernie Sanders could recreate a Swedish egalitarian system, or if Hillary Clinton has it right and things just wouldn't translate.
No, I would lean to agreeing with Hillary Clinton.
We have to remember that Sweden is a small country. The population is very homogeneous.
Two votes for Hillary. What about our expat bartender, though? He's a Bernie guy.
Feel the burn. I'm feeling the burn over here in Stockholm.
Same question. Could Bernie Sanders import Sweden's social democracy to the U.S.?
I think Americans are a little bit scared by the word socialism, obviously. I think the population's just too much to handle that kind of change. And
So you agree with Hillary?
No. I mean, yes, in the way that I don't want to ever say that.
But perhaps these people in Sweden are being too skeptical. The U.S. is already partly a social democracy. We have socialized medicine for the poor and old, public education, and social security. And for those who say wealthy Americans will never pay 60% in taxes at the margins, under Republican President Dwight D. Eisenhower in the 1950s, they paid more than 90%. For the World, Jason Margolis, Stockholm.
Here's a politics story that goes back a lot further than 1950. For centuries, laws in Britain have been formally written out on vellum. Sounds really, really old school. But now the British Parliament is set to ditch vellum and enter the paper age. Sharon Hodgson is a member of Parliament, and she's a big fan of vellum.
Vellum is actually calf skin. It's treated by heritage craft makers where they take skins, you know, hides that aren't used for making leather, and they turn them into what's known as vellum, which is, it feels very much like a stiff card, but it can just go through a regular printer and be printed on, or calligraphers can write on it, and it lasts for thousands and thousands of years with no special treatment, no special conditions.
Have you handled old vellum laws from hundreds of years ago?
Yes. Recently, when this whole debate started, I wanted to go and see all the laws. And so I was able to see sort of all the, you know, the Great Reform Act, the abolition of slavery, you know, universal suffrage, which, you know, just had that, the Suffragette, the famous movie, all printed on vellum. And also then she pulled out an Act of Parliament going back from Elizabeth I, you know, going back so many hundreds of years. And I said, oh, well, have I got to put special gloves on? And she went, no, you can just touch it. Just look at it. You know, vellum is so sturdy. You don't have to worry. No special conditions are needed. So I can't see why, when there's something that exists that is so sturdy and will last for centuries, that we would want to scrap that in favour of using parchment paper.
Is anyone making a humanitarian argument? Oh, we don't want to use calf skin. We're going to go to paper. Or is it purely a money-saving thing?
Nobody's made that argument. It purely just seems to be a money-saving option. Nobody's used the animal rights argument because no animals are harmed purely to make vellum. Vellum is literally a byproduct of an industry that is already happening. And if these skins weren't sent to be turned into vellum, they would just be scrapped.
You formally raised your concerns in Parliament. What's the next step? I mean, is there any prospect of this decision being reversed?
Well, I'm ever the optimist and ever hopeful, but they say they're going to stop using vellum on the 1st of April. And they've took this decision in the mother of all parliaments without a debate, believe it or not. So I'm putting down what's called an early day motion, just, you know, see if we can get a stay of execution and hopefully maybe a reversal. But, you know, we should have at least had the opportunity to debate this in Parliament on the floor of the House.
Sharon Hodgson is Member of Parliament for Washington and Sunderland West, and she's been protesting about the plan to abandon vellum. Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Coming up, a Chinese cartoonist exiles himself. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Here's a worrying trend. Over the past few months, a number of Chinese dissidents living outside of China have simply vanished, only to turn up later inside China and in government custody. Patrick Wins with our Global Post team. From Bangkok, he's been following the story of the disappearances.
The first one to really shock people was a publisher in Hong Kong, which is typically assumed to be a refuge for people who want to criticize the Communist Party. He simply vanished. There was also a publisher in Thailand who vanished as well. Both of these guys made a career out of writing critiques of the Communist Party, publishing their scandals, writing sort of tabloid fodder. and then they simply vanished and popped up in Chinese custody in mainland China.
Is there a pattern to who is being targeted and what they're being accused of?
They range from journalists who are writing about serious abuses and guys that are writing stuff that is more tabloidy. So the guys that I just mentioned, they were prepping a book, we're told at least, they were prepping a book about the love life of Xi Jinping, Chinese president. So they're not all major exposés. Some of this stuff is more like what you'd find in the National Enquirer, but it apparently is enough to infuriate the Communist Party.
How many cases are we talking about? You've mentioned two. How many over the case of a couple months?
In recent months, we're looking at about 8 or 9 that we know of. Not all have just vanished and popped up in custody. Some in Thailand, for example, there were 2 dissidents that were sent back through legal channels. These were gentlemen who were seeking asylum. The UN was assisting with that, and yet they were sent back anyway, which did not make the UN very happy at all.
China's been detaining and arresting dissidents for a long time. What's new or noteworthy about these cases?
Well, what's really shocking is their ability to grab people across borders. This is a new phenomenon. You know, everyone knows that in China, if you criticize the Communist Party, you might be imprisoned. But it was long assumed that if you at least were outside the country, that you could say what you wanted. So there's a lesson here. If you want to criticize China, you need to flee outside of China's backyard. Certainly not Hong Kong, certainly not Thailand, which is also a military dictatorship and an ally of China. These are not safe spaces anymore. The lesson to dissidents is you need to get farther afield, perhaps to Europe or the United States, a country that is willing to infuriate China by upholding principles of free speech instead of sending people back into Chinese custody.
Has, say, Thailand confirmed that they helped out in these arrests?
With the gentleman that vanished, no. They've been pretty cryptic about that. With those that were sent back, the ones I mentioned who were applying for asylum through the UN, yes, they've been open about that, although they don't particularly enjoy answering questions about it. The circumstances under which the gentleman that vanished disappeared is very murky. The assumption is that agents of the Chinese state were able to operate in Thailand and shoo them back towards the mainland, but not much is known. In fact, I don't even think it's known how exactly they left the country of Thailand to get back into China.
It seems that snatching up dissidents from outside of its own border is rather a brazen step for China. What does it say about China's power in the region and in the larger world?
Certainly in Southeast Asia, China has really asserted itself in the last 10 years. You don't want to make China angry if you're Thailand, Indonesia, even Vietnam, which has a more tense history with China. They have so many economic links that you just don't want to upset them. Now compare that to the U.S., which previously has seen Southeast Asia as its backyard, certainly during the Vietnam War. They're more willing to upset the U.S., Western rights groups who criticize these disappearances. They'd rather have them angry at them than the Chinese state for very obvious reasons. You know, their economy is at stake.
Patrick Nguyen reports for our Global Post team in Bangkok. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks, Carol.
And now the story of one Chinese man who decided to disappear on his own. He's a cartoonist who goes by the pen name Bario Chao. I follow global political cartoons here at The World, so I've known about Bario Chao since he went into exile in Australia a while back. And one thing I always wanted to know, the meaning behind his name.
Actually, it doesn't mean anything. I just pick it with the sound because any meaning behind it can refer to my maybe real identity. So I choose to just choose a random name for myself.
And for the time being, you're keeping your real name to yourself for security reasons.
Yes.
What are you trying to achieve with your cartoons?
I think cartoon is a great way for self-expression, especially for me, because I'm probably not a good writer, but I know I can draw. And with my drawing, I can give the word my voice. Also, I think cartoon is a good way to, let's say, against the dictatorship. Because when we talk about dictatorship, they always tend to be very, you know, serious and not funny, trying to be very strict. But cartoon is a human way to deconstruct this kind of authoritarian and making people laugh.
Of course, it doesn't make everyone laugh. As I understand it, when you were still in China, your Weibo account was hacked into a number of times. What kind of censorship did you experience when you were still in China?
When I was still in China, my account was keep being deleted. They stopped me to reopen it again. And actually, I think I've reopened my account for more than 30 times because they just keep suspended or deleted. So I have to log on and do everything again.
Your cartoons are tough. One of them is a takeoff on the hit series House of Cards. Your cartoon calls it a China original series. It stars Mao, Deng Xiaoping, Xi Jinping, and others. Why would you compare China to House of Cards?
I think it's an interesting TV series, kind of showing how the politicians are fighting and eating each other, which actually refer to China as well. The current president, Xi Jinping, is actually fighting his way to the very top by, I don't know, probably setting his enemies into the prison, like Bo Xilai. So that's good a comparison.
Mario Chao, what do you hope to achieve with your cartoons?
I think cartoon is a good way to challenge the authority or the dictatorship. So I want to use my cartoon to kind of deliver this message to say, as individual, we can still have our voice. If you're good at speaking, you should speak out. If you're good at drawing, you should draw your stuff. So that's what I do. And I think my voice is also can be one to defeat or to making the history more objective. So that's what I want to say. It's the individual voice.
Are you reluctantly in exile in Australia? Meaning, would you return to China if things changed in a certain way?
Of course. I mean, nobody really wants to leave home unless you have to. For my example is, I want to be an artist. I always want to be, but I know the environment in China. There's never really enough space for free creation. You really have to pay a price to practice your own art. So that's why I choose to go overseas.
Mario Chao is a Chinese political cartoonist. He's now living in Australia. An e-book of his cartoons has just been released by China Digital Times. It's called Watching Big Brother, Political Cartoons by Mario Chao. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Later, giving small family farms a leg up in Brazil. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. A Liberian author ditches fairy tales and writes a children's book about corruption instead.
If children begin to identify different means and ways that corruption affects society in a negative way, then hopefully the next generation will do things differently. That's my inspiration, and I hope that that will happen.
That story's just ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Mexico is a dangerous place to be a journalist, and the southern Mexican state of Veracruz is especially dangerous. In the past 5 years, violence linked to drug cartels has left more than a dozen reporters dead or missing. And on Monday, another reporter was kidnapped in Veracruz. Her body was found a day later. The World's Monica Campbell joins us from Mexico City. What do we know about this latest victim? Who was she?
Well, her name was Anabel Flores Salazar. She was 27 years old. She was a mom of two young children, an infant, in fact, one of them. And she worked for a newspaper in Veracruz. And Veracruz hugs the Gulf Coast of Mexico. She covered local crime. She reported recently on the case of a store owner who had been murdered. But she also reported on other things, like a lot of journalists do, work for small papers.
What happened to her?
What we know is that she was dragged from her home before dawn on Monday in front of her family by a group of armed men. They appeared to be wearing military uniforms, and they claimed to have an arrest warrant. We don't know for what, though. She'd vanished. Her body was found yesterday, tossed along a highway in the neighboring state of Puebla. She was bound, and she had a plastic bag over her head.
Oh.
Awful.
Had Salazar been reporting on the drug cartels?
Well, she'd reported on local crime, and a lot of local crime in a state like Veracruz has ties to organized criminal groups, in particular the Zetas. The Zetas are probably one of the most ruthless cartels in Mexico, and they're very entrenched in Veracruz. So if you're a reporter in Veracruz, inevitably, if you're doing any sort of crime reporting, you're going to be bumping up against these organized groups and vulnerable to revenge.
In reading the Wire copy about this story, you get the feeling that the local authorities are sort of blaming the victim and suggesting that she was hanging out with drug cartel people. What are the local politics on this?
That's a really clear pattern in Veracruz. Instead of coming out of the gate, seeing a dead journalist and saying, "This is an awful thing. We need to protect freedom of expression," we see them condemn the journalist, create some fuzzy ties with organized criminal groups, and then all of a sudden it paints the journalist in this dark light and starts to blur the investigation from the start.
But why is this happening over and over again in Veracruz?
Cartels have a lot of sway. They have a lot of cash. They have a lot of power to corrupt politicians and also the state police, for example, to be able to smuggle drugs through the state and not worry about consequences and kill people who complicate their business. Duarte, the governor of Veracruz, he himself has been linked to the Zetas drug gang. I mean, the level of collusion between law enforcement and the cartels themselves, they say, goes down to the very core of, you know, daily life in a place like Veracruz, which makes it very difficult to report on because, you know, who's going to protect us if those who are supposed to protect us are actually more entrenched and devoted to protecting the cartels?
The Committee to Protect Journalists has urged the Mexican government to put an end to this cycle of endless violence. Is anything being done to respond to these journalist murders?
What I think the reality is, and what we're seeing in a place like Veracruz, is that the Mexican government is hard-pressed to respond to these types of crimes because of the level of power that drug cartels can also wield. And it doesn't help when at the local level you have governors who also appear to be entrenched with these cartels. Not only that, it's not just journalists being killed. We see mass graves turn up all the time in Veracruz. The missing journalist, dead journalist, is just one part of the bigger story in Mexico.
You mentioned you went to Veracruz and talked to journalists about how they do their work. What keeps them going in the face of this kind of threat?
One journalist I talked to said, you know, when you see your colleagues being killed, you're tested by that. Not only that, he said he recently tried to report on what would seem pretty simple for a lot of U.S. journalists, and it was a crime scene where a woman was found dead on the side of a road. He went to the crime scene. The state police told him to go away. He said, "This is a public scene. I should be able to report on it." They threatened him, he said. They told him if he didn't get away, he could face the same fate. He left. I mean, just even reporting a simple crime scene, I think for a lot of journalists in Veracruz, is becoming extremely difficult. I mean, you don't really have investigative journalism in Veracruz, but for a lot of journalists, the state is home. It's where they have family. It's where they have roots. They're devoted to the state. I think it's just a matter of living and trying to do your job in one of the most dangerous places in Mexico.
The World's Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Thanks, Monica.
You're welcome.
There was good news out of Liberia last month when it was declared free of Ebola. The virus couldn't have hit at a worse time. Liberia is still recovering from years of civil war. Hundreds of thousands died in the fighting, and half the Liberian population was displaced. The conflict also wreaked havoc on the country's education system. Many teachers in Liberia don't even have a basic education themselves. But one family that fled the country decided to come back and tackle that problem. From the capital, Monrovia, Prue Clark has our story.
In 1989, Mamawa Freeman Moore was a teacher and the mother of three little girls in Liberia. She just won a Fulbright scholarship to spend 2 years studying education at Columbia University. It seemed to her family like she'd won the lottery.
To myself, it was like surreal, but everybody agreed. You say, "Oh, it's a good idea, go ahead."
Mamawa's mother and sister moved in to help with the girls, and she got on a plane for New York with no clue what was about to engulf her country. Then came Charles Taylor. Within months of Mamawa's departure, he launched the Reign of Terror that would kill 250,000 people. Mamawa's husband fled the besieged capital with the girls, carrying them on his back, sleeping in the forest, eating whatever they could find. In New York, Mamawa heard nothing.
The only news was what I saw on CNN.
There are no landline, no cell phones.
No.
News reports from Liberia were filled with stories of brutality in child soldiers. On top of it all, she was pregnant. She would give birth to a son in New York, not knowing whether the rest of her family was alive or dead. After the baby arrived, she made a decision.
I went to my sponsors and said, I have to go home. I don't know how, but by the grace of God, I have to go home. Go find them somewhere, somehow.
Mamoua flew to neighbouring Sierra Leone, and on the border, she found a woman fighter who knew where her family was and was willing to bring them out.
After almost a week, she brought my family. It was a joyful day, very, very happy, but I'll never forget that day.
25 years later, Mamoua is back living in Monrovia, and her daughter, Waitu, has opened a bookstore here.
With words so small they had to pinch their eyes to see. Where are they at now? What are we looking at now?
In the market.
They're in the market.
Waitu Moore was 5 when they fled. She remembers the emotional reunion with her mother and eventually settling in Houston, Texas. She also remembers the trauma that made her a shy little girl, plagued by nightmares. Mamoua encouraged her children into the arts, hoping it would provide some relief.
I read and wrote and read and wrote. I was just an avid reader. My face was always buried in a book, and it helped me to heal in a lot of ways, helped me to find my voice.
In 2014, Waitu took her first trip back to visit her parents. She was once a traumatized little girl who'd found a sanctuary in books. Now she was sad to see the children of her country didn't have the same outlet. There were no bookstores or libraries. Reading was not something children did for pleasure. They only read when required for school, and Waitu quickly realized why. Like most poor nations, Liberia depends on donations of books from the West.
And these books are about Bobby playing baseball and, you know, Cindy on the cul-de-sac and, you know, and cricket, because there are some books that will come from the UK as well, and pizza and things that really aren't typical of the everyday local Liberian child. So what are examples of Bagba that happened in the story?
Waitu set out to make books that spoke to the kind of real experience she'd had. She called her sister an artist, and together they produced the first book ever done for Liberian children. They formed a publisher, One More Books. An artist brother and other Liberian writers joined in. And when Waitu was back, she leads story time readings of these books in her bookstore.
100 Liberia dollar given to the police officer.
Today's book is called Bagba, one of the books in the series. The title is a Liberian word meaning corruption. Bagba is on the curriculum in 10 Liberian schools. Mamoua and Waitu are pushing the education ministry to adopt it more widely. They know this is just one piece of a very complicated puzzle.
It's my duty, because I could have easily been, God forbid, stuck in the war, and I could be the woman who's sending my daughter out after school to sell just to make ends meet and to support our family. And I would hope that someone came back and, you know, cared enough to give to her.
And Waitu's first book, a magical realism novel set in Liberia, will be published later this year. She'll use any publicity to persuade donors to invest in books that will make African children excited to read. For The World, Prue Clark, Monrovia.
We were curious about the book Waitu was reading there, the one with the title Bagba, meaning corruption. I mean, who writes a children's book about corruption? We called up the author, Robtel Nije Paley. She's a Liberian academic and activist, as well as an author, and she's currently a senior researcher at the University of Oxford's International Migration Institute. Robtel, thanks for joining us. What happens in Bagba? What's the plot?
Essentially, it's a book about twin characters, Sendema and Sendega, who live in the port city of Buchanan, where my mother's family is from. And they leave Buchanan to visit their aunt and uncle in Monrovia. And along the way, they have a series of experiences that remind them of this word, Bagba. It's a Bassa language word that means trickery. I won't give too much away, because I think it's a story that a lot of people will want to read. And it resonates with not only Liberian children, but children across the world. It's a universal tale about ethics, accountability, and integrity.
I read the book, and what's interesting is the children observe a sequence of interactions that illustrate corruption, basically.
Sure. And people often ask me, what's the inspiration for the two kids? They're essentially my niece and my nephew, Courage and Chrisetta Pabai, who are incredibly precocious. They ask questions. They don't take a no for an answer. And these kids are children who interrogate corruption in many ways because they've had the foundation in Buchanan with their parents who constantly remind them about what it means to be accountable not only to their communities but also to their nation.
Why do you think it's important that Liberian kids hear and read a story about corruption?
It's entrenched in Liberian society. It's a facet of everyday human interaction, unfortunately. And so it's not just about government or public sector graft. It happens in every single sector of Liberia. And I think if children begin to identify different means and ways that corruption affects society in a negative way, then hopefully the next generation will do things differently. That's my inspiration, and I hope that that will happen.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from kids themselves in Liberia?
The children love the story. First of all, they recognize street names. They recognize fruit names. They recognize things that they see on a day-to-day basis. They also like the fact that there's a girl and boy. So it resonates with both girls and boys in the country. I've done readings with children across Monrovia, Liberia's capital. And before I start to actually read the story to the students, I ask them, have you seen Bagba in your communities or in your school or in your church or in your mosque? And it's astounding that these kids are incredibly astute. They can identify forms of Bagba or corruption across their own experiences, which is quite frightening. But I think, again, if children begin to identify these acts as corrupt practices, and hopefully my goal is that they will subvert that in their adulthood and do things slightly differently.
I'm curious what the reaction is of their parents and teachers since they've dealt with corruption and observed it for much longer. Do they have a different reaction to the book?
What's interesting is that some of the adults are implicated. So when I did the readings with the kids, many of them told about adults in their lives who are engaged in corrupt practices. So it's an interesting sort of tense-filled experience. But, you know, often people talk about the fact that the book exposes corruption through the eyes of 8-year-old twins. So I think adults recognize that perhaps if children begin to talk about these things, they might embarrass them into doing the right thing.
When I read it, by the end of it, I wasn't sure whether the twins' aunt was actually corrupt or not corrupt.
That's a story for the sequel.
Okay. What other huge abstract topics would you like to see kids get to read about, especially in West Africa?
I would like to see more stories about ethics beyond the corruption. I think there needs to be a conversation about what it means to have integrity and what it means to be an ethical person in society today. We've had folk tales that use anthropomorphic characters, and I'd like to see human characters in these storybooks that children, again, can see themselves. And that resonates with their own experience, as Waiitu set out to do with one more book.
I understand Bagba, the book, now has a theme song. How did that come about?
So I applied for and secured a grant from the Open Society Initiative for West Africa. And a part of the grant initiative was to adapt the book into a song as well as a video. And so I partnered with Liberia's premier hip-hop musician, Takunje, to do a video and song adaptation. So the song is called Bagba is Corruption, and it was released in February in video form by Takunje. We're so excited because it's gotten rave reviews and people are dancing along to the song, but also, again, having that national conversation about how corruption affects us negatively, politically, socially, and economically.
Rubtel Nijay-Paley is a Liberian academic and activist, and she's the author of the book Bagba, which means corruption, and it's a kid's book for West Africans. Thanks, Rubtel.
Thank you. Bagba is getting too much. Say no to corruption, you'll be all right. Bagba is getting too much, oh.
Just ahead, the Supreme Court deals a blow to the president's plan to clean up the coal industry. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Not so fast there, Mr. Obama. That's the message the Supreme Court sent to the president last night when it put its plan to clean up the country's electric power system on hold. The decision is at least a short-term victory for 27 states and energy industry parties. They'd challenged the Obama administration's plan to cut pollution from power plants by more than 30%. The World's environment editor, Peter Thompson, joins me now. Peter, this was such a big deal when it was announced last summer, and the president and others in his administration Commission have argued since that they were on very solid legal footing. So what's up with this decision?
Yeah, it was a pretty big surprise, Carol, as you said. The Supreme Court has held for a decade that the EPA has the right to regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act. That's a 40-plus-year-old law. That is the foundation of the Clean Power Plan, and that plan, in turn, is a major part of the commitments that the U.S. made at that big climate summit in Paris in December to help fight climate change. But that's now all in some doubt, although we won't know its ultimate fate for quite a while now, probably at least until after the president leaves office next year.
That's pretty incredible. How did this whole thing come about? Who got together to force the court to come to this decision?
Well, what happened was that a coalition of states and fossil fuel industry interests sued the administration over the plan. They said that it overstepped EPA's authority. They weren't specifically challenging them on the issue of carbon dioxide, but on the degree to which the plan dictates big changes in how states must handle their energy mix. They also argued it would cost thousands of jobs in the coal industry and push up the price of electricity. So an appeals court in Washington is now reviewing those arguments, but has declined or had declined to put the plan on hold in the meantime. The challengers appealed that decision to the Supreme Court. Now the High Court has said that, yes, the plan should be put on hold until it finishes working its way through the courts.
So essentially, the parties that oppose it are saying it's a case of federal overreach. So what happens now? I mean, what's the future for this plan? Could it be dead?
It could be. The lower court will hear arguments later this year. But whichever way it rules, the fight will almost certainly end up in the Supreme Court itself. And in effect, yesterday's decision was a statement by the majority of the court that the challengers have at least a reasonable chance of succeeding.
Do you think the Supreme Court has signaled that they're likely to rule that way, that the Clean Power Plan does go too far?
Well, it's all tea leaf reading there, of course, but there are some interesting leaves to read. The pivotal player, of course, is, as usual, Justice Anthony Kennedy. The one-paragraph order in the case yesterday made it clear that Kennedy was among the five justices supporting the stay, so he's clearly in play. And his record on relevant cases is definitely mixed. So the fate of what is arguably the biggest piece of President Obama's climate change agenda could come down to Justice Kennedy.
The World's Environment editor, Peter Thompson. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Carol.
Finally today, Brazil is the world's top exporter of soy, sugarcane, and coffee. Most of the country's growers are small family farmers, and they struggle to compete with big industrial farms. But the Brazilian government's been trying to change that. Here's reporter Ritu Chatterjee.
It's a windy day on the farm surrounding Promissão, about 300 miles north of Sao Paulo City. A few brown cows graze nearby, watching us warily as we walk between rows of pumpkin plants. I'm here with two farmers, both women. Dona Marinova, the owner of this farm, is in her 50s. The other, Joyce Lopes, is 38. And together, they run a farmers' cooperative. Lopes and Marinova dive into a field of short manioc or cassava trees, hunting for tubers. They bend down and pull them out with their bare hands. Lopes holds up a tuber covered in dirt. They'll sell this cassava root to a local school that will prepare it as part of its school meal. Public schools have become a regular source of income for the 20 or so farmers in their cooperative. Lopes says earlier they used to have to go through middlemen to sell most of their produce.
We had to accept whatever they offered or we would lose everything.
But for the past 3 years, she says farmers like her have been able to bid to supply to local schools directly, and they're much happier with what they make.
After we started working with the school meals program, it helped a lot. There were times we didn't have anything, and suddenly a little bit of money came in from the program, and I would say, oh God, this money came at the right time.
Here in São Paulo, we feed around 900,000 students per day.
Danuta Miwelska is an education official in Sao Paulo City and works in the city's school meal program.
And we serve about 2 million meals per day. So if we think about how many food we need to buy to provide all those meals, it's a huge market.
But until recently, farmers like Lopes and Marinova didn't have access to this market.
It's not just payment. Many times the farmers are not seen, like invisible people.
And yet, most of the food Brazilians eat is grown by family farmers. That's why in 2009, the government passed a law requiring cities to spend at least 30% of their school meal budget on goods from family farmers. Miwelska says it's helped the farmers and it's improved the quality of school meals. For example, Sao Paulo now buys organic rice from family farmers.
We ask for rice and they offer organic rice.
But implementing the law isn't always easy, she admits. Many cities still don't buy the minimum required from family farmers. Corruption and lack of political will can get in the way. And some of the farmers don't even have the resources to participate in the program. But those who do say they are finally getting ahead. Like Joyce Lopes back in Promissão. Sitting in the living room of her two-bedroom house, Lopes tells me the extra money she's been earning has gone into home improvements.
O quarto do Luiz, né, que a gente...
We are doing my son Luis' room, and we did a bathroom for our bedroom too.
Managing the cooperative and supplying to public schools has taught her new skills.
Actually, it's taught me to grow things that I didn't before. It taught me how to work with the producers, how to explain things to them.
It's also forced her to deal with people outside her community, to participate in public biddings. All experiences that have made her stronger, she says. That afternoon, I visit Lopes at work in her sister's home up the road from her house. The entire family is busy preparing for a delivery to schools. They line up big green crates on the porch and label each one with the name of the school and the order. Joycey, in shorts and a cotton top, is clearly in charge. Other farmers in the cooperative will bring 40 heads of lettuce. She and her family will supply the eggplants. Her sister-in-law weighs them and puts them in a crate. When the crates are filled, a rented truck will deliver them to schools. She says the cooperative will soon get their own delivery truck with a government grant she applied for, which means they'll be able to increase their profits. It takes a lot of organization and financial planning, says Lopes, but she loves every bit of it.
I like doing this. People make fun of me, but I like to dig into a project, deliver it, go to the meetings.
You're a successful businesswoman.
Yes, I am. I consider myself one.
For the world, Ritu Chatterjee, Promissão, Brazil.
Ritu's reporting was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. And from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.